solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the fourth episode of Connecting the Dots. This one is on identity. We recently crossed 100 guests at the podcast, and we are pressing the pause button on getting new guests, and we are using the opportunity to take stock and reflect on some of the learnings we've had at the podcast over the last 5 odd years. For the next several weeks, each new podcast episode will be a compilation around a theme, where I try and connect the dots between the various things we've learned at the podcast across the guests. We will do this for a period of time, and then after a few months, we'll get back to the long-term march towards adding to the library of guests at the podcast. We wanted to go through this phase of consolidation and taking stock before building further. To put it differently, we want to go through a phase where we pause collecting the dots and focus on connecting them. I sincerely hope you find these compilations of value. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm based in Mumbai, and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals play to their unique potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite and there are only so many people I can work with. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen on playing to their potential. To know more, you can visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Okay, let's now talk identity, the topic for this episode. I tried to look up the definition of identity in the dictionary, and this is what I got. It is the distinguishing character or personality of an individual. The way I understand it, the simple way to understand identity is possibly the labels we attach to ourselves and the people around us. If I take my instance, I see myself as an Indian, Tamilian, husband, son, father, friend, executive coach, sounding board, podcaster, a male, and so on. You get the drift. We all attach different labels to who we are. In this episode of Connecting the Dots, let's talk a little bit about identity, the role it plays in our lives, and how the way we relate to it can be a big determinant in us playing to our potential. Let's first look at why it makes sense to study identity closely. If I look at the 60s and 70s, a father's generation, professional identity was closely tied to the educational qualification, and it was quite static through your career. You studied MBBS, you became a doctor, and you stayed a doctor. You studied CA, you became an accountant and stayed an accountant, and so on. But today, the link between education and careers have become very fluid. Plus, the careers don't look like a long motorway like they did earlier. They look more like a maze. Pramod Sinha, chairperson of Ashoka University, speaks about how the link between education and careers is becoming more and more tenuous.
In fact, this whole thing about, you know, specializing in a subject and then being in a career and the line to that, as you know, is tenuous. It happens sometimes, but increasingly happens less and less. And so while it's important to major in something, it's not really that important to major in the right thing.
That's a good point.
And so that kind of releases the tension of a lot of parents and children when they realize, or sometimes they don't, but most of times you can actually show the parents themselves that what they major in and what they're doing now has no connection.
It helps not to hold on to an identity very tightly. The other interesting aspect about identity is that due to centuries of evolution, The human mind tricks us to thinking that all the big changes are behind us. And that is another reason why clinging to our identities can be counterproductive. Jennifer Garvey Berger, one of the leading thinkers in the space of leadership in a complex world, speaks about it here.
In the book, you also talk about how we think about change. You say that every age, we feel like we are done with our evolution and we are wired to believe that our big changes are behind us. I found that observation quite interesting, just in terms of how we process the curve of change with time when we look at the past and when we think about the future. Why does this happen and how does that impact the way we function?
I think it's a fascinating result, right? It's a fascinating result that says that most of us spend most of our lives believing that our major changes are behind us. And I wonder whether there's a kind of a psychological health. I don't know the answer to this question, so I'm just musing here, right? Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything that actually explains the why of it. But I have wondered whether there's a... It takes so long for us to develop into the time of our life, this sort of self-transforming time of our life when we welcome change and move towards it, as opposed to initially resisting it or finding it destabilizing. And so I wonder whether our brains have evolved to sort of trick us into believing it's all going to be okay from here so you can relax, as opposed to having us on constant alert our whole lives. So there's a kind of a, you've arrived, to take a breath is kind of what our body and our brains are telling us, when really there's no such thing as arrival, right? The world is mm-hmm. going to keep getting more complex. Our lives are going to keep changing. The demands of our lives are going to keep changing. And therefore, we're going to need to grow better and better able to meet those demands.
I find this insight from Jennifer interesting. To use a metaphor of trekking, it's visually often easy to estimate the height we have ascended, but often very hard to understand the peak that we are yet to climb. That's often because the peak is often not easily visible. We end up underestimating that very often. The other reason why identity is useful to study is that very often how we see ourselves is how the world sees us. Deepa Malik, the celebrated Paralympian, speaks about this. Her story is a really inspiring one. She led a fully healthy life till one day, due to an unfortunate medical situation, she was paralyzed below her waist. She speaks about how she came to terms with it and resurrected her life. She speaks about the notion of how we see our own identity impacting how others see us.
I think I have come to learn a lesson in life that people will look at you the way you look at yourself. If, as long as I was treating myself as a patient or as somebody who was disabled or have a sad persona around me or still despair and losing legs and not moved on, I was looked upon like that. But the day I took charge of my situation, I said, no, I'm going to be as normal. Well, I'd never say that I'm abnormal. But I would. And actually, there is nothing that I don't do which people with all functions intact in their body do. I drive, I swim, I play, I watch movies, I listen to music, I cook, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a homemaker. And I write some poetry and I have hobbies. I travel. So there's really nothing really different. And that's what I crusade for. I call myself a person on a mission called Ability Beyond Disability, who actually advocates that the differences are, I think, just a matter of thought and not matter of action. If you really take charge and do it as casually, people also take it that way.
I guess this is as relevant in the case of situations where you have an identity that is slightly different from the rest of the population. Dori Clark, the author of many books, including one titled The Long Game, that we discussed in our podcast conversation speaks about how she relates to the identity of being a lesbian.
Well, you know, ultimately, ever since I was a teenager and I came out, I just was never interested in trying to hide anything or to sort of contort my personality in some way. And I really am a big believer that other people generally take their cues from you. It is a very small percentage, a tiny percentage of people that are so hostile or so hateful to, you know, whatever, you know, whether it's your religion or your race or your sexuality or whatever. It's a very small percentage of people that are going to be aggressive towards you just because. But I really think that for the vast majority of people, they are looking to you for guidance about how you should be treated. Mm. And for me, it is really important to just be myself and be comfortable and be confident, because in doing that, it's showing other people, okay, good. Well, you know, great. Let's be normal. Let's be comfortable together. And I think that when we come at people from a friendly and open position where it's, you know, I don't have anything to hide. You know, it's of course it's perfectly normal to, you know, to talk about a girlfriend rather than a boyfriend or whatever. If you make it not a big deal, it's not going to be a big deal. And that's the world that I would rather live in. I don't think that we need to make things a big issue. And I also think we don't need to be cowering in the corner, worried about what other people think. I think that we have actually a lot more power than we imagine to influence the discourse and to influence our relationships. And so what I try to do as best I can is hopefully be helpful to other people in the future by just setting a framework and expectations that, yeah, no, you know, no big deal. This is nothing to notice, nothing to worry about. Let's just get on with business and being friends.
This is such powerful wisdom from Deepa and Dori. Sometimes we end up getting into a victim mindset, and that can inform our body language and the way we connect with the people around us. I think we have much more agency than we can imagine in the way we shape our identity. The first few pieces were just to give you a sense of why I think identity is important and why I think we should pay attention to it. As Pramath says, the link between careers and education is getting more and more tenuous, so we should avoid clinging on to some of the identities from the past, often driven by what we've studied. We need to recognize that we are work in progress, and very often the road ahead is often a lot longer than the road we have traversed, as Jennifer says. So being light-footed is helpful. Finally, how we relate to our identity can have a profound impact on how the world deals with us, as Dori and Deepa discuss. Let's now move forward. The one piece to recognize here is that we all at any point in time are juggling multiple identities. However, I've noticed that we do a poor job of doing justice to many of them and end up leading a unidimensional or relatively narrow lives. I find that there is a slow compounding curve at work with each identity, and it either grows or depletes depending on how much time and attention we give to that aspect of our lives. In my case, I learned the guitar over the weekends with my son. Being a guitarist is part of my identity. However, this identity of mine will grow or deplete depending on how much time and attention I give it. One could argue that once you cross a certain plateau of capability, you can still keep the identity without investing incremental time. Possibly, but there are some domains where I find that it's like juggling a brittle glass ball. If you drop the ball today, one often doesn't have a window to come back to it in the future. Parenting is one such case in point. I feel it is a finite window that is open for a certain period of time, beyond which the door is shut. The unfortunate part is that the parenting window opens about the same time as when we are operating in power play mode in our lives and going all guns blazing on the work front. No easy answers here, but being mindful of the various identities we have and staying true to the extent possible is the only way out. In some of the clients I work with, I often get them to reflect on the identities they care about. The exercise requires you to find a quiet spot for half a day or a full day where you're not distracted and you don't have any devices pinging or disturbing you. Imagine yourself 5 years out. Not 10 years, it's too far out. Not 1 year, it's too close. 5 years. First, you think of the various identities that matter to you. For each of the identities, try and find an adjective for that. For instance, caring parent, loving spouse, competitive long-distance runner, ambitious professional, and so on. You get the drift. One identity and one additional word which qualifies the kind of person you want to be in that domain of your life 5 years down the line. Write down the list of 5 to 10 identities that you care about in one page. Don't rush this. Take your time. Once you're done with this, write down each of these two word combinations in a separate page. If you had 10 identities, take 10 sheets of paper and write the two words on the top of each sheet of paper. For instance, one page would have caring parent, another page would have loving spouse, another page would have ambitious professional, and so on. Now take each page and ask yourself why multiple times. Why is that important to you? Stay with one page for a few minutes, as long as it takes. The idea is not to rush the process. And this process is like going down an iceberg. Initially, you will discover some feelings and emotions you have around that identity. As you ask why and go deeper, you will find that you unearth your values and beliefs. As you go deeper, you're likely to find some basic needs you're trying to meet or fears you're trying to avoid. There's no right answer here. The idea is to just stay with the page and go as deep as you can till you get a sense that you've gotten to the bottom of the iceberg. You then move to the next page and continue this exercise and go down the bottom of the iceberg and so on till you complete all the pages. I've noticed that doing this exercise every few years gives you a sense of what your portfolio allocation looks like. Or should look like. Very often, when we get consumed by the rough and tumble of daily life, we lose track of what our portfolio allocation ought to be and end up focusing on 2-3 elements of the portfolio and ignoring the rest. And that delta can over time lead to dissonance. Doing something like this can give you a sense of anchor as you go about your life. I guess each one of us needs to find our own mechanism for juggling with multiple identities. One example of somebody who really juggled multiple identities seamlessly was Gandhiji. Dr. Ramachandra Guha, his biographer, speaks about it here.
So I think it's best to read out just 3 paragraphs of my book to explain how Gandhi himself saw his multiple callings.
Uh-huh.
So here I'm reading out Gandhi in his what I say about Gandhi, and then there's a quote of Gandhi in between.
Sure.
To deliver India from British rule was by no means Gandhi's only preoccupation. The forging of harmonious relations between India's often disputatious religious communities was the second. The desire to end the pernicious practice of untouchability in his own Hindu faith was the third. and the impulse to develop economic self-reliance for India and moral self-reliance for Indians was a fourth. These campaigns were conducted by Gandhi in parallel. All were to him of equal importance. In 1933, he wrote to a close friend that, quote, "My life is one indivisible whole. My life is one indivisible whole. I cannot devote myself entirely to untouchability and say, neglect Hindu-Muslim unity or Swaraj. All these things run into one another and are interdependent. You will find that one time in my life, an emphasis on one thing, at another time on another. But that is just like a pianist, now emphasizing one note and now another. But they are all related to one another," end of quote. And this is what I say in the end. For Gandhi, political independence meant nothing at all unless it was accompanied by religious harmony, caste and gender equality, and the development of self-respect in every Indian. Other patriots had used the Hindi word Swaraj to signify national independence. Gandhi made Indians aware of its true or original meaning, Swaraj or self.
Fascinating.
Yeah. That is Gandhi in his own words. And that's also why, as I told you a little while ago, I don't believe in saying this is the most important thing because this is the one route to success. You know, Gandhi conducted these multiple careers and saw them of equal importance. And at different times, different aspects of his work came into the forefront, others receded, then those came into the forefront, and so on.
I love the insight here about the interdependence between some of these threads and how Gandhiji pursued these threads separately very well, knowing that all of these were of equal importance. Even someone like him, who was the father of the nation, I guess had a troubled relationship with his sons. I guess there's no perfect answer here. The best we can do is to be deliberate about some of this and keep the identity map front and center as we think about allocating our time and attention as we go through life. The trap here is that we have the propensity to allocate the marginal unit of time and attention towards that aspect of life that yields immediate rewards and gratification. Late Clay Christensen of Harvard speaks about that with remarkable clarity in his book, How Will You Measure Your Life? And without us realizing, that can lead to us dropping a few glass balls once and forever. If we look at the phenomenon of midlife and look at people that are stuck in what they call a midlife crisis, I feel it very often boils down to a dissonance at the level of identity. There is a tension between who we are and who we want to be, or who we want to become, and there are some hard constraints which often come in the way. It could be money, it could be relationships, or it could be something else. But identity is often at the crux of the midlife anxiety. No easy answers here. I guess it varies from case to case. Let me try and share a few perspectives that might help you take some baby steps in a meaningful direction. The first idea I want to share with you is that of liminality, the phase of being in between. You're neither here nor there. This is a term I learned from Herminia Ibarra of London Business School. Her book, Working Identity, is a must-read if you want to delve deeper into the topic of identity. I guess this is the equivalent of vanaprastha that's often discussed in the Vedas. We all need to go through a phase of living in the forest as nobody to figure out the way forward. You can also tune into a conversation at playtopotential.com. You can find her in the guest section. Herminia says that when leaders are in transition, they need to look at two axes. On one axis is exploration. You can explore narrowly or divergently. On the other axis is commitment. You can commit early or you can delay your commitment. I hope you can imagine a 2x2 developing here. She says that most people end up exploring too little and committing too soon when they are at a phase of transition. She suggests divergent exploration and delayed commitment. And a prerequisite for that is for us to be comfortable with the concept of liminality.
When you're making a transition, people think you go from A to B, but you don't. You go from A to this transition thing, which we call liminality in our technical jargon, to B. Mm-hmm. So in between, you're neither here nor there, and it's horrible because you lose your identity anchors. And so in that space, it behooves you to be a little bit more playful because you're neither here nor there. So that means you don't have to be consistent, and you can try and you can talk to people about jobs you'd never consider, or you can do things that are pretty much out of character, but you know you're trying to learn something. And that can be very freeing because we don't often give ourselves permission to deviate.
There are no corporate guidelines.
No. And so the two principles are, as you said, divergent exploration and delayed commitment. Divergent explorations is, what I mean by that is, whenever I teach people who are in transitions, one of the first things I do is I say, write a list of your possible selves. They don't have to be feasible. They don't have to be public. They don't have to be something you're committing to do. But just let your imagination run wild. What's the set of possibilities? Do a kind of brainstorming with yourself. Don't be embarrassed to write. Even if it's ridiculous, put it in there. And it's really interesting what people come up with. It's quite, in fact, we are very multiple and often quite divergent. Doesn't mean you're going to do all of those things, and certainly not at the same time. But when you get permission to be divergent, there's a lot there. And in fact, one of the things that is hard for people in transition is they feel that they must not be ready because they're considering such a different array of options. And they feel that somehow that's wrong, that they are equally passionate and excited about two things that seem mutually exclusive, like getting promoted at my current firm and then starting up a business on something completely different. And one day you're excited about this and the other day you're excited about that and you think you're out of your mind. But in fact, what we're doing is trying to explore and compare and contrast, and how do I feel here and how did I feel there? And so when you give yourself, and that's why it takes time, that's why the time factor plays in, to explore more divergently and say, this is actually natural and it gives me more information so that then I can make the right choice. You make better decisions and you're less likely to do the other thing, the foreclosure, which is take the first thing that comes your way because it's been 6 months and I can't tell people anymore that I'm still, you know, out of work. So the delayed commitment comes from understanding that it's going to take time and you're not going to go for the first thing that comes up or the second thing until you really had a chance to test. Because once you jump, you're going to be stuck there at least another 2 years. And so why not take a little longer at the beginning in order to make a more robust choice?
When I interact with individuals who are having a midlife crisis, if I may use the term broadly, the biggest barrier often is their discomfort with embracing liminality. I've also noticed that the discomfort is directly proportional to the extent of success in phase one of life. These people have often climbed a mountain on the professional front and now experience the angst when there is a dissonance between who they want to be and who they are, but the fall is just too steep to embrace liminality. In this context, let me share another insight from Bruce Feiler, author of the book Life is in the Transitions. He speaks about how stories of different faith have this element of going into the wilderness.
There is something about the fact that the great stories of every faith involves going into the wilderness in some aspect. It's in the Hebrew Bible. It's in the Hindi tradition where you go into the forest. It's in the Buddhist tradition. It's in the Muslim tradition. Okay, it's in the story of all of the great mythologies have somebody going on a journey of some kind. And that journey in a fundamental way is leaving what's secure and safe and going into this period of lack of confidence and wilderness and transformation and fear. So if the first phase is the long goodbye, where you accept it and you use rituals in some way, the next step involves taking a step and going through that process. And that brings you to the Indiana Jones scene, where let's remember, here he's in one place and there's a cliff and there appears to be no bridge. He actually has to take a step, and then the bridge appears after he takes the step. That's what it's like to go into this messy middle. And it involves two processes fundamentally. The first is to shed some habit, some way of life. Maybe it's shedding you like having a job and it's shedding that comfort of stability. Maybe it's shedding a habit that maybe you've been a people pleaser and you've stayed around something for too long and it's taken you too long to say goodbye. And you realize you have to stop trying to please your boss. Maybe you have to stop trying to live up to the expectation of your parents, that dare I say it. Okay, maybe your parents have fed you these expectations that you must have a certain status and you must bring in a certain kind of money and you must do something that you don't want to do. And you realize, I'd rather do something that I want to do. Or maybe you have to say, I want to stop making money and I want to start giving back to society. You want to shapeshift. So you have to shed some expectation. This is the first half of what the messy middle involves. And then the second half is absolutely astonishing acts of creativity. Once you shed things from your life, you suddenly have room to try new things. Okay, maybe it's a new habit. Maybe it's a new skill. Maybe you start to paint. Maybe you start to dance. Maybe you start to sing. Like, people literally do actual things. Like, I think when the pandemic happened, everyone was posting pictures about learning to bake, right? That was I may have been the only person who was not surprised by this, because even the act of baking something small, it's an act of reimagining. If you can imagine that you can bake something and that you can eat that, and that little act of imagining that creation allows you to imagine that you can make and bake and create your new life. And that's what happened. It begins with small steps, just like Indiana Jones, sometimes on a bridge that you don't even know is there.
I really love the Indiana Jones scene that he talks about. I would strongly urge you to pause this, go to YouTube, and type Indiana Jones Leap of Faith. I think the scene captures the crux of the insight beautifully. You will have to first take the leap of faith into the unknown, and only then will the bridge appear. And that fear of losing one's identity by taking that leap into the unknown is the piece that often gets to people who are in positions of power. The more tactical way in which this manifests is the question they often ask me. If I took 6 months off or a year off and came back, would the search consultant still talk to me? My response to that often is, when you embrace liminality, you may not come back to the place where you started. You might end up in a very different place. What that is, we will never know if you don't take the leap of faith. It's a bit like COVID. When we went through COVID, we didn't come back to the old normal. We came to a new normal. I guess embracing liminality is a bit like that. It's an opportunity we all have to find a new normal for ourselves when we are stuck. A good place to start is to try and keep our identity small and not get consumed by it. Not easy at all, but it's a baby step in the right direction. James Clear, author of Atomic Habits, speaks about how we can ensure we can be a little light-footed when it comes to relating to our identities.
So let's think about this from a big picture level first. So you have identities that can build you up. For example, like, I'm the type of person who reads a lot, or I'm the type of person who finishes workouts, or I'm the type of person who finishes what I start. And then you also have identities that hold you back. So, something like, I'm terrible with directions, or I'm bad at remembering people's names, or I have a sweet tooth, or I'm bad at math. And we are all a collection of identities. Like, they're all multiple things that are part of you. Like, you might say, I'm a dad and a brother and a neighbor and a volunteer and a teacher or whatever. But it's not just labels that are part of your identity, like dad and teacher and friend It's also those internal beliefs, that narrative that you assign to yourself. And the more that you let one of those beliefs take over your entire identity or kind of occupy too large of a portion, the more that you are fragile or brittle in that way. Because if you lose that one thing, then it feels like you lose your whole self. So as an example, you often hear this with people who are in the military. They might define themselves, part of their identity might be, I'm a soldier, right? I'm a good soldier. And then once they leave the military, suddenly they're not that anymore. And so there's this like loss of identity. There's this sense of self that they feel like they lose. On a similar level, I felt that when I stopped playing sports. For like 20 years, a big part of my identity was, I am an athlete. And then all of a sudden, 1 year, that was the final time I played. And then I wake up the next day and what, am I not an athlete anymore? That's like who I was defining myself as. And so I think one way to get around this is that you can focus on the more enduring aspects of a particular identity that you can take with you or carry with you into a new context. So for example, in the soldier's case, they could say, well, rather than assigning the identity, I'm a soldier, I could assign identities like I am reliable, or I'm a good teammate, or I have the back of those around me. Well, that's something, even once you're not a soldier, you can come back into the workforce or go to a business, you can still be reliable and be a good teammate and so on. Same way for athletes, they could say something like, you know, I'm the type of person who trains my body hard, or I'm consistent and show up to work each day. And like, you can do those things as an athlete, you can do those things as an individual. So part of that is the separating of the identity or the defining it in a better way. But the other aspect of this, and this is the part that you referenced with Paul Graham's quote, keep your identity small, is that the tighter you cling to any individual identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. So you see this in pretty much any area of life. The tighter you cling to the idea that, you know, like a teacher who's been teaching for 20 years and they have their lesson plans figured out. It's like, this is the way it is. The tighter you cling to that, the harder it becomes to grow beyond that, learn new, different learning methods, new learning modalities, change your course structure, et cetera. The surgeon who is like, this is the way we do the operation, even though there might be a new technology that allows them to do it in a less invasive manner. The tighter you cling to that previous identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond. And this is one of the real challenges for building habits, which is that early on, building a new identity is a really valuable thing because it can get you to stick to the habit. So for example, let's say that you're not fit right now, but you want to start getting in shape. Building the identity of I am a runner is a really valuable way to get you to stick to the habit of running. But then what happens, you know, 20 years from now, if you injure your knee or your hip and it's not possible for you to run anymore? Well, now you feel like you've lost this sense of self. And so you need to transition to a new identity. And so the process here is not like a line. It's much more like a circle. You're continually evolving, continually updating and expanding and revising your beliefs. And you really need to be committed to doing that. And if you can keep your identity small, it makes that process easier. Because you're it's like retouching a painting. If your identity is so large that it consumes everything about you, then all of a sudden getting rid of that aspect feels like you're tearing yourself in two. And so for all of those reasons, keeping your identity small can be a valuable way to continue to grow, evolve, and expand.
As a matter of fact, it's useful to pause and think about how identities take shape. Let me bring in Lloyd Reeb here. To give you some context, Lloyd Reeb is a successful real estate developer and owner of Retirement Housing, who made a midlife transition looking for greater meaning, joy, and impact in his second half. He's had the privilege of investing 20 years helping leaders plan their second half. He helped launch the Halftime Institute, a global team that teaches, coaches, and connects successful men and women in pursuit of significance. Lloyd has taken the halftime message around the world, speaking, teaching, and coaching individuals through the journey. He speaks about how leaders often approach midlife with their passions smoldering under the wet blankets of busyness obligation, and responsibility. He speaks about how a seed in the form of an interest in an area becomes a tree in the shape of an identity over time.
Yeah, now this is an area of science, and you might enjoy this because you're a scientist and at heart. That is what I have believed for a long time, that your passions are buried under blankets of busyness, obligation, and responsibility, and that if I could lift the corner and blow oxygen in, they would ignite. And so what I've been doing recently is studying the science of how interest forms. For example, there's a big compilation of social science recently done called The Science of Interest. It's a $100 book. It's very, it's like reading one PhD thesis after another. And so I've been studying that. And I think this is an area where I think I was partially wrong, Deepak.
Mm-hmm.
And let me share with you what I've been learning about how passion forms. So let's say that one of your listeners is in a place where they've got an opportunity to transition. Or they have some extra time because they something's changed in their life and they've got 40 hours of work at work and then they've got 10, 15 hours of free time that they could do something new and they want to make a difference, right? And so let's just say that they're looking for what their passion is. And so here's what I've been learning, and I'll just read to you some things that I think may be helpful. Many halftime clients or many people who come to halftime have not been exposed to a wide variety of human experiences or causes. And as a result, they have not tasted the pain of those issues, nor the joy of those who are helping assuage the pain.
Hmm.
So it's true that for some people, you know, they might have been abused by a spouse and they're passionate about domestic violence. They might have grown up with as an orphan and they may be passionate about orphanage. Maybe they were very sick as a child and they're passionate about that. Maybe they saw their father lose a lot of money in as an entrepreneur and they want to help entrepreneurs, something like that. That happens sometimes. But more often than not, what happens is that this published compilation, The Science of Interest, suggests that people gain interest through stages. They get clear on their passion through stages, from exposure to knowledge about it, to confidence around a particular topic, and then they move into a passion as they engage with the topic and experience joy. And then this new interest becomes part of their identity. And it becomes a passion that they are self-motivated to engage in. So let me tell it to you in a story form for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose a parent notices a child's interest in taking nature photos. So they buy the child a cheap camera. The child takes a few photos. Some turn out, but many do not. And the family celebrates the ones that do turn out beautifully. And the parent points the child to some YouTube videos to learn more about photography. Soon they begin to capture better photos. The parents buy them a better camera. And the family experiences them coming in with great pictures and they start to celebrate them. And the person feels the joy of their family seeing their beautiful pictures. And then as a result, they gain confidence. Next thing you know, they notice the child is out when it's hot or when it's raining, taking pictures, and they're self-motivated to do it. And eventually, they begin to hear the child telling people that he's a photographer. And it becomes part of his identity. So part of what you need to do if you're looking for your passion is look past at what's happened in your past. Was there a painful experience? But then, excuse me, also explore. Explore a wide variety of things through photos, through stories, through case studies, Google searches. Do an urban plunge where you go downtown and see what's happening.
I really love Lloyd Reeb's phrase, passions smoldering under wet blankets of busyness, obligation, responsibility, and so on. In this context, I love the words from the song Be Sabriya from the movie MS Dhoni. Kyun roshni tu bahar talashe, teri mashale andar tere. Actually, they should be sung, not read out. So here it goes.
Kya ye ujale, kya ye andhere, dono se aage hai manzar tere. Kyun roshni tu bahar talashe, teri mashale hai andar tere. Kyun dhoondhna pairon ke nishaan, jaaye wahi le jaaye jahan besabriya.
I'm reminded of a lovely quote by late Sir Ken Robinson in one of his TED Talks. He says that songs sometimes touch a part of the soul that words don't. Definitely true in this one case. Let's move on. If I go back to my journey, when I started on the journey of being a coach and a sounding board, many people asked me to consider becoming a motivational speaker. I wasn't sure what that was, first of all. To me, it sounded a bit like the term missed call or a dropped catch. I cannot give a dropped catch to the fielder. I can only give a catch. The fielder can choose to drop it. Similarly, I can only give you a call. You can choose to take it or miss it. I cannot give you a missed call. Similarly, I struggled to connect with the term motivational speaker. So instead, I chose to be a seeker and became a student of leadership, transition and careers, and the vehicle was this podcast. In a way, this was an experiment. 6 years back, not many in India knew what a podcast was. Today, it's a household name. Recently, somebody called me a podcaster. Now, that's not an identity I would have given myself when I started this journey. But like Lloyd Reeb speaks about the child who's interested in photography, one thing has led to another and has brought me to where I am today. The desire to seek and distribute knowledge has resulted in an identity of a podcaster. The more I study how identities get formed, I see a similar pattern of slow organic growth from a seed to a tree. Let me share with you three examples. Amish Tripathi, Devdutt Patnaik, and Ashish Dhawan. Three very different journeys. Let's start with Amish. Amish actually was the second guest at the podcast, the first being Vijay Amritraj. Amish is an alumnus of IIM Kolkata, and he was pursuing a career in financial services with IDBI. Today, the identity that's associated with him is that of an author, given the number of bestsellers he's written. I asked him to trace it back to when the seeds were sown.
If you're looking for the seeds in my childhood, frankly, they don't exist. I was never creative when I was young. In fact, most of my school and college friends, even friends from IIM Calcutta, when they meet me, they usually say, "Sach pata, actually, kisne likha hai?" I was academically oriented when I was young. I was also active in sports, so boxing, gymnastics, those kind of things. But I never did anything creative. I never wrote anything. I never wrote any fiction before the Immortals of Melua. I never wrote any music. I was the singer of our band in IIM Calcutta, but I never wrote the music. We only performed what others had written.
Okay.
So I was never creative at all. So I think the seeds are to be found perhaps in an incident that happened 11, 12 years ago. When my family and I, we were watching TV and we discovered something interesting. A philosophical discussion ensued. And that was the genesis of the Shiva trilogy. It was a philosophical discussion into the nature of evil.
Okay.
In the family?
Yeah, in the family, yeah. My family, my grandfather was a pandit in Kashi. Both my parents are deeply religious, so we have an atmosphere in our family of our myths, of our scriptures, of discussions, debates on it. In our family, we also read a lot. Everyone reads a lot.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of
stuff? My siblings? I primarily read nonfiction. Everyone has their own favorite genres. My favorite genres are history, spirituality, philosophy, religion, science, politics. I read books in this genre. I read maybe at least 5-6 books every month.
Wow.
I've been reading at that pace for decades. Started reading maybe when I was 5-6 years old. Everyone in my family, my siblings, everyone, we must have at least 1,000 book library at home. We all read a lot. And we discuss and debate a lot. I guess that was the atmosphere.
But having a debate to writing a book, that's still a pretty big
leap. Long journey.
So walk us through just how that phase panned out for you.
Yeah, like I said, it was essentially a philosophical discussion on the nature of evil, on what is evil. It was based on the discussion was based on a TV program that we saw, and we discovered something interesting. We all know that for Indians, gods are called devas and demons are called asuras. We all know that. What many of us don't know is that for the ancient Persians, not the Islamic Persians, the Zoroastrian Persians,
mm-hmm.
The gods were called ahuras and the demons were called daivas. Their pantheon is the exact opposite of the Indian pantheon. So Indra, king of the gods among the Indians, is one of the chief demons among the ancient Zoroastrian Persians. And we triggered an interesting discussion in our family. The ancient Indians and the ancient Persians had met. We'd probably be calling each other evil. Because your god is my demon, my god is your demon. You must be evil. So who would be right? Would the ancient Indians be right or would the ancient Persians be right?
Uh-huh.
The obvious answer is neither. They're just two radically different points of view. But neither of them are evil. They're just different. Evil is something that exists beyond petty human rivalries. So an answer occurred to me to that question that what is evil, partly on some of the Upanishads that I've read and that I've learned from my family, and based somewhat on my own thoughts. So I told this philosophy to my family. They said they liked it, and I was encouraged to write it down as a thesis. That's how it began, actually, a pure philosophy thesis, an answer to the question what is evil.
And when you wrote it at that time, in your mind, who was the audience for that? Was it just as a vent?
No, yeah, it was just for me. I wasn't really... Look, I was a banker, man. I mean, no one wants to listen to bankers, let's be honest. And a banker, going with a philosophical thesis on what is evil, they'll say, yeah, you bankers are evil. I was just writing for myself and for my family, that's it.
And this was in addition to your day job as a banker?
In addition to my day job. And of course, slowly that thesis got converted into an action adventure book. The idea being that through a hopefully engaging story, I'll communicate at the root of it is the philosophy of what is evil. And I'm trying to communicate that through this adventure, through this story. And that's how it panned out.
And picking up from there, Amish, from writing for yourself to writing a book that gets published, what was that journey like?
When I write, I don't really care. Even now, when I write, I'm not really thinking about how it will be received by readers, critics, publishers, or anyone else, frankly.
Uh-huh.
This is how I wrote my first book, and this is how I write today as well. I can't say it was a conscious choice when I was writing my first book because I wasn't even really thinking that it would get published. I guess without realizing it, I was following what Lord Krishna tells us in the Bhagavad Gita, karmanya vadhikariste ma phaleshu kadachana, that you have a right to your karma, not to the fruits of your karma. And we in the modern world have interpreted this wonderful philosophy to mean something fatalistic, which is not what Lord Krishna was telling us. What he is telling us is actually if you are detached from the results of your karma, if you're detached from success or failure, then actually you're unstoppable. If you're doing something simply because you love doing it, simply because you enjoy your karma so much, who can stop you? Because failure can of course be demotivating because it feels, sadness, grief, demotivation in your heart and it stops you.
Sure.
But success can be as dangerous. because you'll find so many people who are one-hit wonders because success feels bright in the head and they lose their way. But if you're detached from success or failure, then actually you're unstoppable because you'll just keep doing what you love doing. And I'm not saying I'm this great philosopher and I consciously figured this out. It's just that I loved doing anything with my book so much that I genuinely didn't care whether it succeeded or not. I wasn't really thinking whether it'd get published or not. I just loved doing anything associated with my books.
And what was the tipping point for you, Amish, to say this could be a full-time career? At what point did you leave the banking job?
It was a pragmatic decision. Look, I come from a middle-class family, okay? So I always joke that mere paas baap dada ka aashirwad hai, jaidad kuch nahi. So I have to be pragmatic and practical in my career decisions. I have responsibilities. I'm blessed with a child. I have a wife. So I resigned only after my second book. When my royalty check became greater than my salary check. And even at that time, I was a member of the senior management committee at IDBI Federal Life Insurance. Uh-huh. So hence I was not just involved with projects in my department. I used to look after marketing, product development and service quality for the company. But I was also involved in projects of other departments.
As part of the leadership team.
Yeah. So I made sure I gave my boss a very long notice pay. I completed all my projects, including ones that I was involved in with other departments. I found my replacement and I trained him. Took him to SMC meetings for a few things so that he was, he got into the groove of it. And I resigned only at that time. My boss threw a farewell party for me, gave me a lovely, very large idol of Lord Shiva as a gift. And so I left on very good terms with him. And I told him at the farewell party also, Salji, kal kuch gadbad ho jaye, to main wapas aa raha hu naukri mein.
So you had the hedge.
I would say it's being pragmatic. I mean, some people may call it boring. I call it being pragmatic. If you don't have family wealth to fall back on, you have to be practical in your career decisions. I always believe, why burn bridges? If you can maintain good relations, what's the harm? You never know when you need a bridge. And even karmically, I think it works. Why attract negative emotions from anyone if you can leave people with good positive emotions?
I love the piece where he says that he quit his job only when the royalty from the book exceeded his compensation. I come across a lot of people that haven't quite crossed the financial independence threshold. Amish's model is one approach. You let the passion simmer in the background and keep that as your 20% project, as they say in Google, where you're allowed to pursue anything that you're passionate about in 20% of your time. In these situations, I think there's a genuine risk of switching too soon. So build the legs slowly over time, and when you have the strength in your legs, start running in a new direction. This is a case of somebody deliberately taking action and moving the career in a certain direction. Very often, we might have a situation where we pursue something and the world starts associating a certain identity with us. Let's look at Devdutt's journey. We all know Devdutt as a mythologist today. But when I did the research around his journey before talking to him, I discovered that he'd spent his first several years in the pharmaceutical industry. In his case, he pursued his passion for mythology till the point the world around him started knocking on his door by seeing him in a new emerging identity.
So I was just a medical graduate who didn't want to practice clinical medicine. I didn't know what to do. You had to earn a living, right? You're a middle class family, your family is anxious, your father is retired. How do you earn money? And I was good at communication. One thing led to the other, and I was in what is called medical communication, writing pamphlets. I didn't realize it was a big thing at that time. I would do it very casually, and I had 8-10 clients, and I was, now when I think of it, I had already a consultation in the very early days, but at that time, nobody told me it was a big thing. I just had to do it because I had to earn money. And I met the right people who taught me how to write better, senior people. I was just lucky. But they always knew I had this interest in mythology, and they used to find it amusing, and we used to have these conversations about it. I joined the healthcare pharma industry for 15 years.
I'm doing this in the free time. I'm writing my mythology. I was writing my mythology and somebody just told me, hey, you know, somebody wants to publish a book. Would you like to publish a book? So I didn't look for a publisher. A publisher came to me.
And was it grounded in childhood?
It was in post-medicine. It was something that usually in the later part of the medical, I would say post-medicine completely. I used to read broadly philosophy, religion, but this mythology as a word actually emerged only in the late 90s. I used the word mythology for the first time, very technically, and I was obsessed with defining it, and nobody was defining it correctly for me. So this, you know, this completely zeroing on mythology happened only in 95, 96. Until there was this vague thing, spirituality, religion, philosophy, where I used to go and pick up my books and it used to excite me. So it was very vague. But really my journey is because series of, you know, opportunities coming my way. You know, the right person who helps me write medical literature. Then I get a publisher who published my books. And I published my first book 20 years ago. And he kept publishing my books, but it was not doing well. That time, nobody read mythology at that time. So I could keep doing my... And then, you know, I joined the pharmaceutical industry. So this was all very organic. Until one day, in this organicness, I used to give these casual lectures with a friend of mine on mythology, Bombay University. Some people in advertising knew me a lot. There were people who read my books in advertising. Santosh Desai, for example, knew me many, many years ago, long before I was popular. And he used to always like me and he used to spend a lot of time with me. He writes Times of India, some of the most complex articles in City, City, Bang, Bang. But, you know, to give you a sense of, there were people who knew, but they were like this tiny segment. And then you're introduced one day to Kishore Biyani of the Future Group and he thinks you have value and he tells you to do it full time. Now this, I didn't plan it. It happened. You know, so that's, these things happen, you know, and or TED happens to me because somebody says, wants to do TED in India. I've never heard TED in my life. Until I went to the venue, I didn't know how important and big it was. I just knew, they said, you know, we want something in mythology. And everybody they met kept saying, there's this guy called Devendra Patnaik. So the lady met me, I said, okay. And I thought, oh my God, why am I going to Mysore to talk for 15? And 18 minutes, I got very angry. What is this nonsense? This is not the way you can teach this.
This is 2009.
This is 2009. So I had no clue there's something called TED. You know, I'm doing my own thing. I've already written 5-6 books at that time. Not 5-6 books, I think 10 books by that time. But it's not popular in the popular sense, the way it is popular today.
Sure.
So it's very organic. So TED happens and then Menaka Doshi walks into my Future Group offices and tells that, you know, we want to do a show on Business Sutra. I don't think she was also sure what she wanted. And I said, you know what, I'm very interested in business and management because by then I had a very good understanding of business. And when I would use these words, nobody's educated around you. So they're looking at you and say, who's... So they used to like, hey, Ramayana Mahabharata story bolta hai. Which was fine because it helped me earn money. But I knew that this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I had seen, you know, now I realize that, you know, you have to see things before others and then show it to them and be patient. And I've been lucky in that journey.
Sometimes the world may not have the language to understand the specific niche you're operating in. But I guess you just need to persist with it. In the case of Devdutt as well, he kept digging deeper and deeper into mythology. And when he started layering it with his understanding of business, he found what I call talent market fit. I guess the point to mention is that just like product market fit, when you come up with something new, you need to embrace the fact that it's an organic process. It's a bit like Steve Jobs talking about the iPad. The customer often doesn't know what he or she wants. You have to show it to them. And then they get it. It's a bit like that, I guess, when you're breaking new ground. However, I don't want you to think that it's all very clean, hunky-dory, and predictable. It's quite messy. Let's take the case of Ashish Dhawan. He's the co-founder of Chris Capital. At one stage, he was one of the most successful private equity investors in the country. He quit that when he was at his peak and started his journey in philanthropy with a focus on education. Today, you would use an identity of a philanthropist in the field of education to describe him. When he thinks about his next arc, you can listen to how he is sowing seeds for the future, but fundamentally recognizing how messy and unpredictable it is. I don't want us to get caught in this notion of telling a story beautifully post facto. It is messy when you look ahead.
You can only plot the rough direction. One needs to be humble enough to be open to seeing how things play out. He's one of those remarkable individuals who had clear career markers at 30 and 45 and had the courage to take those hard calls in going in the direction of his heart. I asked him about how he thought about the future, and this is what he said.
First is, you had a marker for 30 and marker for 45. As you think about your journey from here on, are there any macro markers which you have in mind, which would be your sort of guidepost as you think about choices?
Yeah, so I think one of the things I've been thinking about, Deepak, is how do I think in education, I'm still going to be very focused on it for the next, few years, till at least I'm 51 now, till at least 55. But do I have a sort of slightly wider portfolio of initiatives where I'm going beyond education? So that's, for me, is maybe the next move. I've already started seeding that in some ways. I set up a foundation to focus on air quality. I've got a couple of initiatives been seeded that are around talent development in the sector. I've got to set up a China-India Foundation that looks at learning from China, not looking at geopolitical issues, which are obviously very controversial. So I floated a few of these new things, really because I have multiple interests. And what I've learned from how I can drive impact in education, can I do it in a more leveraged way in a few other sectors, is something that's of interest to me. And beyond that, I don't know. I mean, could I write a book someday or some of that? Possibly. I'm also very focused on having fun in life. I mean, you only have one life. It's not that I don't have fun right now. I do. I have a great time. But, you know, maybe at some point in life, just saying that I want to just chill a little bit. And not always feeling like I need to be a producer, but also just enjoying being a pure consumer. So I joke with my wife that, you know, I'm going to buy a bar on the beach and that'll be next life, you know, serving drinks to people who are working really hard and need a break. But yeah, something different, you know. And so I don't know exactly what that is, but yeah, I do have many other interests in life that are unfulfilled, and around languages, around living in certain places. So who knows?
You can hear Ashish being thoughtful about the future, but at the same time, you see the humility in terms of being open to how things might play out. The conversation with Ashish was one of the most enlightening in terms of how he saw the bend of the river and navigated it deliberately at various points in time. You can tune into playtopotential.com and find him in the guest section of the podcast. Like Ashish says, we need to sow seeds for the future thoughtfully to see how they play out. I should mention a related point here. Sometimes, when you walk a certain path, what you think it is and what it is are often quite different. It's important to keep some sort of a reflection loop or a feedback loop to see how it is going and course correct if required. As you think about embracing new identities, it's helpful to deal with them at arm's length rather than embracing them too tight. Nandan Nilekani, the founding father of what is now the India Stack that's being marketed around the world, speaks about how he transitioned into the world of Lok Sabha politics after his stint in UID, where he drove the Aadhaar project. He speaks about how he took that turn but decided to cut his losses soon enough.
Well, what happened was, first of all, I had always said that I would do this thing for 5 years.
Yeah.
And that it was not like a lifetime thing. So that I'd promised that I would deliver the platform, build the tech, get it rolled out, get applications built like DBT.
Sure.
And we would reach 600 million people. And I reached that stage in March.
Sure.
March of 2014. So that's when I stepped down after I fulfilled my commitments. Now, what I realized though was when I spent that time in the government was that the potential of technology to transform India was not sufficiently internalized by the system, because people didn't come from that background. People were not technological background. Very few people like me were there in the system. So then I realized that I'm a big believer that technological transformation is the way to go, because that's the only way you're going to fix a lot of India's endemic issues. And then I thought, many times I was not able to sell my ideas, saying you can do this, you can do that. So I was getting a bit frustrated with my inability to sell my ideas. So then I said, maybe I should be one of them. Maybe if I'm a politician, then I'm...
You have a voice.
I'll be the decision-making guy. So, and then I have the legitimacy to say this is the way to do it. So that's what drove it. It was an intellectual choice, actually, to get into politics. But my experience was not very happy. And in that sense, I think that was one transition where I stepped too far in some sense. It was way outside my comfort zone. So I, after the election campaign and after that, I realized that this was not where I want to be, that I didn't have the leverage. I didn't have competitive advantage in that area. I didn't think I would be very effective. So I realized that actually my effectiveness comes from being what I'm good at, which is a technology-led transformation agent, and use my talents and abilities to solve large, intractable problems and make that available to anybody who wants to use it. So that was my shift. And then, of course, I explained to you that I was looking for something to do, and then...
The portfolio approach.
I know, and this next step happened, this idea of... And then the whole portfolio approach.
And just back to that transition for, let's say, leaders and CEOs who are looking for a career in politics or considering a career in politics, any lessons or any...
Yeah, so I'll tell you. I mean, it's very simple. A lot of my consensus building skills, which I'd honed in government, were obviously useful there.
Right.
But it is a, first of all, it's an extremely time intensive activity. Retail politics. I'm not talking, there's always this so-called Rajya Sabha route where you get nominated and all, but then you become beholden to someone and they didn't want to get into that situation. So then I said, if I'm going to be in that game, I should win an election, because that's the rites of passage of that business.
Sure.
But then it becomes very retail intensive, because in every constituency, there are millions of people.
It's a B2C.
It's a B2C business. It's a B2C kind of thing. And everybody wants real-time attention. You can't say, okay, send me an email or call center or something. So it's very, very time intensive. It's also lots of pressure groups, different caste, religion, this, that, all that stuff. And also, I was hampered by the fact that I was not a good public speaker in any Indian language. And I don't think you can be in Indian politics unless you're very good at being a public speaker in Hindi or Kannada or Marathi or whatever. So, and there was no, so I didn't have leverage. So I quickly realized that I was not going to be effective in this stuff.
Like Nandan says, in some of these transitions, sometimes you can't really intellectually figure out if you would like it and whether you would have the skills to succeed in that canvas. Some of these things can only be figured out post facto. Going back to Indiana Jones, you can only discover that after you've taken the leap of faith and have walked the path for a while. However, the related dilemma that often comes up is when you embark on a new path, are you cutting your losses? Or are you copping out? How do you tell the difference between the two? Whitney Johnson is the author of the book Disrupt Yourself. She's taken the principles of disruptive innovation that late Clay Christensen of Harvard used to talk about and has applied that to the context of personal disruption and reinvention. She speaks about the notion of each one of us riding multiple S-curves at various points in time. I asked her the question around copping out versus cutting losses in the context of a new S-curve. This is what she said.
So whenever you jump to a brand new S-curve, we know from the theory of disruption, if you're taking on market risk, the odds of success are six times higher, but that's 6% to 36%. So there's still, you know, a 64% chance that it's not necessarily the right S-curve. So here are four questions that you can ask yourself. When you jump to a new S-curve, you're not, it feels like, and you're at the low end of that S and you're like, there's no growth happening. And you don't know for sure if it's really not happening or you just can't see it yet. So four questions you can ask yourself is number one, am I playing where no one else is playing? So the first accelerant of personal disruption. Number two, am I playing to my strengths? So you might have a great idea and you might be playing where no one else is playing. But if you're trying to do something in an arena where you don't actually fundamentally have any strengths, that's going to be tough. The third question you want to ask yourself, is it hard but not debilitating? So for example, if you wake up every morning and there's like this mountain of an S curve that you're trying to scale and you say, this is hard, but I feel alive, then growth is probably on its way. But if you're feeling, if you're dreading your work, maybe even getting sick, these can be symptoms of this flatlining curve. And then the fourth question you want to ask yourself is, am I gaining momentum? You know, if last week it took, you know, 4 hours to do something, this week, does it take 2 hours? Like, are you starting to see some momentum, even though it might seem small, but is that momentum kicking in? And if your answers to those four questions are no, then it's probably a signal that you need to consider certainly tweaking what you're trying to do, but it also may be a sign that you need to jump to a brand new S curve, knowing that no S curve is ever wasted. And one favorite quote I have on this is this is from Seth Godin, marketing genius. And he says, winners quit all the time. They just quit the right stuff at the right time. And so those four questions can help you know. If the answers are no, it's probably time to quit. We know from research that if you don't quit when you should quit, this idea of a stop loss, our bodies actually generate this inflammatory molecule that contributes to things like heart disease and diabetes. And if we don't quit when we're on the wrong S curve, that frustration that we're feeling starts to have this contagion effect in all areas of our life. So winners quit all the time. They just quit the right stuff at the right time.
The other piece I should highlight is that when we cultivate a new seed of an identity, it might involve us to engage with ecosystems that can look and feel very different from the world we currently inhabit. We need to try and avoid being judgmental of this new space and go in with an open mind. Atul Khatri, a successful stand-up comedian, speaks about how he was running a tech business as an entrepreneur and he was parallelly trying his hand at stand-up. He speaks about how different the two worlds were.
Because 25 years, you know, you have your own set of ecosystem, your orbit, as you call it, you know, your orbit of your suppliers, your vendors, your Wipro, your principal, your chartered accountant, income tax, you know, your employees, you know, that's thing. Now I was getting into a different orbit or different ecosystem where there are comedians, there are comedy club owners, there is an audience who's paying you, you know. There is, there are the light man, the sound guy, you know, those suddenly become very important to you than anybody else. So that was, and also you have to realize that most of the comedians, even today, the average age, I think, of most stand-up, of the stand-up comedians in India must be, I think, 24, 25, you know. Wow. And they were half my, at that time, though, they were even younger. So, I mean, I should, you know, work with, you know, comedians sometimes as old as my children age, you know, like, so hanging around with them, going for dinner after a show with them. And, you know, the night before, I have this joke which I say, the one night before I'm having dinner with my 40 plus CEO friends, and when the bill comes, you know, we're having a fight. You know, take my card, you know, let me pay. We're all throwing a credit card inside. Next day, I'm having dinner with all these young comedians, and the bill comes, you know, we have a different kind of a fight. You know, sir, I don't need two rotis. This is my 60 rupees. You know, I had one scoop of dal. This is my 10 rupees. You know, so I won't pay GST. Why should I pay GST? Why should I pay service charge? You know, so all these things used to happen. It was a very funny riding boat, you know, thing. But I'm so glad, you know, it gave me a new life.
I love this insight from Atul. When I started engaging in the world of podcasting, I had to interact with the guy who recorded the sound, the guy who rented the studio, the person who helped compose the title music for the podcast, and so on. And these people looked and felt very different from the kinds of people I'd engaged with as a search consultant. It's like moving from Taj Mahal Hotel in Colaba to the Tapriwali Chai
outside Gateway of India. To Atul's point, I think it's helpful to be humble and be a student in this new space. I can see a lot of people get uncomfortable with the mechanics of this transition. Whenever you find yourself in that spot, you might want to remind yourself what is at stake here. It's a new possibility and a new life that is at stake here. Let me now talk about a slightly different context. How identity gets transmitted from one generation to another. We could call this the Abhishek Bachchan situation, Arjun Tendulkar situation, or maybe a Rishad Premji situation. Very often, the next generation is given the baton to run with, but it's often a mixed bag. The biggest challenge is that while the first generation has often worked their way up while staying below the radar, the next generation often is operating in a fishbowl with the world providing commentary and often sadistically wanting the next generation to fail. In my limited experience, I found that the next generation often has to earn its stripes. You can transfer the business, but the title of a businessman has to be earned. And sometimes, the path may be non-linear. I discovered this in my conversation with Stephen M.R. Covey. Stephen M.R. Covey is a leading thinker in his own right in the field of trust. He's the son of the legendary Stephen Covey, who's written the book Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. This was possibly the very first book I read in the genre of self-help, which is possibly the space I'm operating in today in a broad way. I asked his son, Stephen M.R. Covey, how he found his identity while growing under the large shadows of his father.
Well, here's the interesting thing, Deepak, is that when I decided to join the company, this was before the Seven Habits book had been published.
Interesting.
But I knew it was going to be published, and I knew that people would resonate with it because my father had been speaking about it, talking about it for years, but until the book was out, it was hard to scale, and so I had different opportunities to join. I'd done investment banking, I had an opportunity there on Wall Street. I had an opportunity in real estate development where I'd worked before. Some exciting opportunities, and I chose to join with just a small company that my father kind of had founded because I felt like this had a chance to truly change the world, to impact people everywhere. And it didn't look like it at the time to an outside observer, but I felt like it could. And I think I was right because the impact my father's work has had has been enormous and it's impacted people everywhere. And so, I felt compelled to that because I believed in it and I believed in what my father was doing and I thought it would have a great impact and that I could help be a part of that. But it was kind of difficult, especially at first, to kind of carve out my own identity, carrying my father's name. And he was the thought leader and the speaker and the teacher and author. And so initially, you know, I came out of a Harvard Business School. And so I felt like what I could do, what I could contribute initially was a focus on the business side to turn my father's ideas into a business. And so that's where I spent my energy was focusing on that. I became, after learning the business for a while, I became the president and CEO and ran the company. And I kind of, my identity became one kind of like, well, my dad's the thought leader, you know, and I'm the business guy and, you know, building the business and growing it and forming partnerships around the world and the like. And I kind of felt like that was kind of my strength and my role. And, you know, so my dad talks about it and I helped turn it into a business and help us scale the business. And we did, we figured out a business model that worked because prior to this point, we always had a great idea, a great customer value proposition, but we hadn't figured out how to make money and we hadn't figured out how to be scalable. And so we needed to learn that. And that's what I felt like I helped bring to the firm. And then we were able to.
And this is Franklin Covey, just to understand. Yeah,
this was actually before the merger. So this was what was called Covey Leadership Center.
Okay.
Covey Leadership Center, which later merged with Franklin Covey, with Franklin Quest to form Franklin Covey.
Ah.
Yes. So the early days of Covey Leadership Center, and my role was the business guy. But then, interestingly, it was in the merger when we merged the Covey organization with the Franklin organization. Franklin was really big into time management. Mm-hmm. And we had our own foray into time management with my father's First Things First work. Suddenly, these two arch competitors in the marketplace, Covey Leadership Center, Franklin Quest, now we are combined. We're merged. And initially, it didn't work at first because it was bad strategy or a bad deal. No, it made complete sense.
And what's the timeline on this? When did this merger happen?
This was clear back in 1997.
Wow.
1997. So Covey was established in 83. It had been going for 14 years. I joined in 89 when we were just, you know, a few people before the book came out. Mm-hmm. And then I became the CEO and ran it for 3 years as CEO. Then we did the merger and in 97. And at first we struggled. And it's because we were coming at it from different angles, different approaches, different mindsets, and we'd been competitive in the marketplace for years. And so there was some distrust there. And I saw firsthand, Deepak, the high cost of low trust. I saw how everything slowed down, everything cost more. And we recognized that we were not going to achieve the potential of this merger if we didn't build trust with each other. So then we made a conscious, deliberate attempt to say, we've got to build trust internally with each other in this merger to achieve what we're trying to achieve. And we worked at it. We focused on it. And we became intentional about it. And we began to move the needle on trust. And we, long story short, is we went from low trust to high trust. And that changed everything. Then I saw firsthand the great returns to high trust, how we can move faster, less cost, more creativity, more innovation, more commitment, more inspiration, more passion. And I came out of that whole experience saying, wow, trust matters enormously. And we all know that, but I came to the conclusion that we are underestimating the impact of trust by a factor of 100. Mm-hmm. That it's far greater than any of us imagine. Trust matters. You can move it. You can actually build it, grow it intentionally. It's not just you either have it or you don't. No, you can move the needle. You can build trust on purpose. And it's the most significant thing you can do. And I recognize that most of the stuff on trust, most of the books and the like, they either were too academic or too simplistic, kind of like just trust everyone and you'll all work out, you know. And I said, no, this is such a practical, tangible idea, trust and really currency. We've got to get good at this. And so I found my voice of what I wanted to do now as a thought leader. And I think I went down the business path for two reasons initially. One, I was good at it. Mm-hmm. But two, I was a little bit reluctant to try to follow in my dad's footsteps because no matter what, I was not going to measure up to 7 habits of highly effective people. I mean, that's hard to replicate. And I thought, you know, that's a little bit daunting. But suddenly what was interesting, Deepak, is once I found my message that trust is the most significant thing, it's the one thing that changes everything and it's learnable, I suddenly lost the fear of trying to be a thought leader myself and following in my dad's footsteps as a thought leader, as an author, as a speaker. And I went down that path and I wrote The Speed of Trust, followed by Smart Trust, followed by Trust and Inspire, which we're going to talk about today. And,
fascinating.
But when I found my message, I found my voice and I lost the fear. And that's kind of the second act in my career. So first act, business person helping to build a business, scalable, reach people worldwide. Second act, now I also have something to say. And that's that trust is the most significant currency of our time. That's the idea. That's my two-act career.
I love how Stephen M.R. Covey slowly developed the identity of a thought leader by going through his own journey rather than directly take the baton from his father. If he'd done that, the chances are the story might have panned out very differently. Just a final thought before we conclude this episode on identity. So far, we've spoken about us having agency and being thoughtful about how we sow seeds and cultivate our identity meticulously. As you would appreciate, life is not as predictable as we think it is. Let's hear from Bruce Feiler, author of Life is in the Transitions. He speaks about life quakes, situations where we feel the carpet has been pulled under our legs. Here's Bruce speaking about a life quake.
And so a life quake is kind of a massive, kind of sudden burst of change. It's either because one of these events is very big or more common. And this is an idea that I'm prepared to say I just never read in the literature of human development. And that is that these disruptors tend to clump, right? Just when you're thinking about leaving your job, you know, your wife gets cancer, right? Or just when you wreck the car, your daughter has an anxiety disorder and your mother-in-law needs surgery. So for whatever reason, they clump. I actually think the reason is sometimes coincidence, but more often it's like one disruptor kind of weakens our immune system. Mm-hmm. So when we're weakened, something that would otherwise be a small disruptor kind of tips over to become a life quake just because we're tired or we're exhausted or we're just sort of in the mood to change or sort of, you know, whatever, let's throw caution to the wind. And now's the time to really, okay, everything's already destabilized. My, you know, my partner has got an illness and my child has a problem. And you know what? I might as well change jobs. It's just something about the confluence of them leads us to kind of push in some ways and embrace change.
Bruce goes on to say that when we get hit by life quakes, very often we try and bounce back to normal and try and be resilient. But he says that that's often a missed opportunity. He says that maybe we can take the opportunity to rethink our identities and shape-shift into something different. The new normal, as we discussed earlier in this episode.
Well, let me first of all just say that there has not been a more fetishized word in business and in life in the last decade than resilience. And the problem with resilience is that resilience is one of those words and ideas that grew up back in the linear age, back when our lives were shaped by the factory and by industrial manufacturing. Resilience actually is a term of physics that began with the spring. And so the idea was that you would pull the spring and how resilient, quote unquote, the spring was how far the spring would spring back into its original position. So that implies that you go back after going through a life transition. And some people go back, but frankly, many more people go sideways or forward or to a different direction altogether. So resilience is not the model. And the pandemic is a perfect example of this. If you think when it first happened, we all thought, oh, we're going to wait 6 weeks and we're going to go back to normal. Well, we're looking at a year plus at this point. And what we've now learned is we're not going back. We're going to a different place. And in fact, that's why when we get in, you know, as we go forward in this conversation and start talking about the various kind of stages and phases of a life transition, that the first one is to say goodbye to the world that is not coming back, the world without the loved one or without the job or without the title or without the legs or whatever has been lost in the original life quake. So instead, what happens is that we rethink what's important to us. And so kind of the quick and dirty on the idea of the shape back to the original shape conversation we were having is that there are kind of three pillars we have to how we make meaning in our lives. I call them the ABCs of meaning. And the A is agency, what we do or make or create. The B is belonging, our relationships, our colleagues, our friends, our loved ones, our co-religionists, the people we volunteer with. And then the C is a cause, a calling, a purpose, sort of something higher than ourselves. So we all have a way that we kind of balance these. I'm an ABC. I'm a writer, so I'm very agentic. I'm very involved with family and a very active dad. And cause is kind of less important to me. My wife, Linda Rotenberg, who starts who started and runs an organization called Endeavor that supports high impact entrepreneurs in 50 countries around the world. She's very cause oriented. She gives back to entrepreneurs all over the planet. Then she's very agentic because she's, you know, a founder and a builder and a social entrepreneur. Relationships, you know, she tolerates the rest of us. So she's like a CAB. So what tends to happen when we go through a life quake is that we rebalance. Like maybe we've been working very hard and we want to spend more time with our family, or maybe we've been a caretaker or caring for an aging relative or a child, and maybe we're now moving on from that and we want to give back, or maybe we've been giving back in our career and we want to do something more for ourselves. So what tends to happen in these life quakes is, because they are sort of breaks in the normal, they are opportunities, and in some ways I would even say obligations, to rethink what's most important to us, and allows us to kind of breathe, take stock, and maybe then shift our priorities somewhat.
I love the pithy framing that Bruce has: agency, belonging, and cause. As you might have gleaned so far in this long episode, this topic is an area of personal curiosity and interest, and I could go on and on. I would say let's hit the pause button here. I hope I gave you some thoughts to provoke reflection as you take stock of your life and move forward with deliberate intent. Thank you for tuning into the fourth episode of Connecting the Dots. If you want more, you can go to the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com and tune into the various nuggets under identity. If you like this format of Connecting the Dots, you might like the last three we published. The first two were on self-awareness. The third was on listening. You can also tune into the content from the various guests at the podcast by going to the guest section at playtopotential.com and finding the various speakers there. Please do let me know if you have any feedback on the format. Anything you want us to do more of, less of, or differently. That would be really valuable for me and my team. If you think it is relevant, do consider sharing this episode with your friends, batchmates, colleagues, or anyone else who might be grappling with this whole "how do I break out of this current gridlock" question that we loosely title midlife crisis. I think developing a healthy relationship with our identity is a key part of the puzzle. Thank you for listening and for your attention. Do also consider rating and reviewing us at Apple or Spotify or wherever else you consume this content. It would really mean a lot for us to keep raising the bar on what we do. We also have a WhatsApp group where we share one or two pieces of content for a week. While we run the Connecting the Dots series, we'll be sharing nuggets along related themes. Over the next few days, we'll share some nuggets on identity to build on what we discuss here in this podcast episode. If you want to receive this communication, you could just note this number, +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. All you need to do is add this number to your contacts and then send a WhatsApp message stating interested, and we'll ensure that we add you to our list. Thank you for listening. The next podcast conversation is about breathing life into work. Look forward to having you there. Bye now.